Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
A Living History production.
This is the Living History Podcast, broadcasting live across the airwaves.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us again for another episode of Living History. Thank you for all the feedback you sent after last week's episode. We got a lot of good responses to our episode about Fromelles. And this is part two of our story of the Australians on the Somme in 1916. Today we're going to talk about the Battle of Pozières, which was really the second part of this story. It was really a saga in two chapters: the Battle of Fromelles, which occurred on the 19th and 20th of July 1916, and then the Battle of Pozières, which is Australia's first proper involvement in the huge Battle of the Somme. And Pozières would go on to be the most costly battle in Australian military history. So just a really profound subject, a really important one to talk about. I think it's interesting that in recent years, Fromelles has probably overshadowed Pozières a little bit because of the discovery of the mass grave and the story that we told in last week's podcast. But it wasn't always like that. For a very long time, Pozières was considered one of the most, if not the most, important Australian battle on the Western Front. So we're going to talk about that today and break it down in detail. And joining me to do that is the guest from last week's podcast, and she's back again. It's Jo Hook from the UK. Jo, thanks for joining us again on Living History.
It's a pleasure. Nice to be here again. Nice to be talking about the Australians on the Western Front. So thank you for
now. I should say this is that you are obviously from the UK and you know your British military history very, very well. But we're blessed with Matt McLaughlin Battlefield Tours that we have guides who may be based in the UK or based in France, but live and breathe the Australian story, and that's certainly the case with you. Tell us what it's like leading these Australian groups on the battlefields of the Western Front.
Well, it is different to leading British groups, and I think you get a kind of complacency, I think, with British groups because we have such a wealth of history. I mean, you know yourself, come over to England, come over to Great Britain, and there's history wherever you step, and it goes back thousands and thousands of years. And so we get kind of complacent. But for the Australians, really, the First World War is the time their nation first fights as a nation in its own right. And I think the focus on that, and certainly I'm always amazed that the amount of Australians we get coming over. For us, this is just like, you know, I can be in Ypres by lunchtime today by just getting on the ferry. But for the Australians coming, the distances you guys come from, it never really ceases to amaze me. But there is a real passion for being able to trace relatives and to walk in the footsteps on the battlefields of where these guys fought. So, hats off to you guys out there in Australia.
Well, I think you're very humble as well, Jo, because you tell the Australian story better than I think most Australians, and that includes me. One of our most highly regarded guides on the battlefields, and the feedback we always get from people is just how passionate about remembering these men you are. That it's something that you do very well. So, you know, it's a great experience to walk the ground, and this is going to be an experience we're going to discuss today when we talk about the Battle of Pozières, because one of the most special places for me on the battlefield, the place I've been visiting for the longest on the battlefields, the first time the Australians participated actively in the Battle of the Somme on the Somme battlefields, and a battle that would go on for 6 weeks and cost the lives of 23,000 Australians killed and wounded, which makes it the most costly battle in Australian history. So just even just those statistics just send a shudder down your spine. And when you walk the ground, it's a small area. The village of Pozières, which has been rebuilt on the site of the original, of course, was destroyed during the fighting and it's been rebuilt. It's not a big area. It doesn't take long to walk from one end of the village to the other and out into the fields where the Australians died. It's a pretty extraordinary place, especially when you group it together with the battle we discussed last week, the Battle of Fromelles. They're just extraordinary stories, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely. And you're quite correct. I mean, the Somme battlefield in which those 23,000 lives were lost is really no more than, I would say, a kilometre and a half square, would you think, Matt?
Yeah, I think that would be right.
And the various phases you group it with, so part of the Pozières where the Australians fought also includes Mouquet Farm. And Geoffrey Malins, who was the cinematographer at the time, he filmed that iconic Battle of the Somme film where you see Hawthorne crater going up. He called Mouquet Farm the most superbly defended position on the whole of the Somme battlefield. And that plays a huge role when we talk about Pozières. And as you quite rightly say, 23,000 lives. If you put that into perspective, that is just a little bit less than the Australians suffered during the whole kind of 9 month Gallipoli campaign. So that gives you a kind of perspective in an area that's no more than a kilometre and a half square, 23,000 lives. It's a huge number. And I couldn't agree with you more, Matt. It's sacrificial ground for specifically for the Australians.
And not just are those figures horrendous, but you think about the timescale as well. 6 weeks we're talking about here. You know, it took 9 months to lose that many people at Gallipoli, but in only 6 weeks we lost the same numbers here. So it's the thing that always absolutely shocks Australians is when you just give them that. I mean, we don't want to break war down into statistics, but it does really sum it up that when you first walk the ground of the Western Front and you say to people in those first two battles between, you know, in July and August 1916, we lost more men in our first two actions on the Western Front than in the Gallipoli campaign. It's just extraordinary. And it's the important thing about the Western Front compared to Gallipoli. Gallipoli always will deserve its place as that first action and the, you know, it's iconic and I love going to Gallipoli.
Yeah.
But the real, you know, mass killing and dying occurred on the Western Front. It's just it's an extraordinary place. And there's nowhere that sums that up more than Pozières. So we're going to talk about the battle and we're going to talk about walking the ground, but I think what we should do is let's break it down into three stages so it's a bit manageable because it was quite a big action. So let's talk about the opening phase of the battle and the first attack on the village, and then we can talk about the attack on the windmill and the German trench lines, and then we can talk about that advance up the ridge towards Mouquet Farm. I think those are the three big phases of the battle that can break it down to be a little bit more manageable. So just to put it in historic context, we're back on the Somme battlefields. The Battle of the Somme had been raging since the 1st of July 1916 when the British lost all those men in that initial first day advance. They then changed tack a little bit and it became this battle of attrition and the British were slogging their way towards the German lines with varying levels of success along the line. And now fast forward 3 weeks, we're at the 23rd of July. The Australians have had the disastrous attack at Fromelles a few days earlier. But now some new, fresh Australian units are being called on to fight their first action on the Western Front. So tell us about those Australian units and what they did in those opening days from the 23rd of July onwards.
Okay, so Matt, initially ordered to attack the 1st Australian Division. Now they're under command, that the overall commander for the 1st Australian Division is the one ANZAC Corps commander, a guy called Birdwood. But he's under command of another guy who is a controversial character, and I say that very, very loosely, a guy called Gough, and you know exactly who I'm talking about. When I was doing my master's degree, I tried to find something that I could say about Gough that was in any way giving him his due, and I could find nothing. Now, Gough is an impetuous character. He's overly ambitious. He's a bully. This guy, he bullies his own staff officers. And when you read a little bit into his character, you can almost see his staff officer saying, yeah, whatever, we'll just do what he says. just for a bit of peace of mind. But he ordered the 1st Australian Division under the divisional commander, a guy called Walker, General Walker. And General Walker is a really good commander, because Gough almost orders them into attack straight away. And Walker puts his foot down and he goes back to Birdwood and Birdwood's chief of staff, Brudenell White. And he said, "My men are not prepared. My guns are not registered." And Gough quite impetuously says, "No, you will attack straight away." And Walker virtually puts his foot down and says, "No, my men are not going to attack. They're not prepared. The guns aren't registered." And he manages to get a postponement with the support of Walker. So they get enough time for him to be able to get his men into position to get the Australian guns to register onto target. And
let's just explain what we mean there, Joe, when we talk about register. Tell us exactly what that involves with the artillery.
Okay, so what that means is you will have spotters, so you might have aerial reconnaissance, or you will have observation posts. And what they're looking at, they're looking for the German frontline positions. Aerial reconnaissance is looking for German batteries that are out of the line of sight. And what they then do is they send back map coordinates. This is all put on to a trench mapping system. The map coordinates are then sent back to our artillery, so our Australian and British guns. And then with the use of artillery science, which goes about 3,000 miles above my head, they are able to register the guns so the fire, they fire on the map coordinate from where the German batteries and German positions have been spotted, so that you can fire a gun what we call indirectly. So you can't see it with the naked eye, but using all this trigonometry and science, you are able to hit them on target. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's an essential part of warfare during the First World War, is that the artillery was essential to infantry attacks, and the guns had to be shooting accurately. So they had to be sighted into targets. So sorry, I took you off on a bit of a tangent there, but it's an interesting facet. And it's a vital one when we're talking about battles like the Battle of Pozieres.
Yeah.
So tell us more about the 1st Division and what they were asked to do.
Okay. So the 1st Division, their main objective was to take the village of Pozieres. Now, what the Germans had done, they had defended the village like a stronghold. So you have a number of trench systems, and all these trench systems were named on the trench maps. You have Pozieres Trench, you have K Trench, Tramway Trench. But the village where it sits, and if you go on the battlefield, some of you, when you join us on the ground, it sits on the main Albert to Beaupalm road, which intersects the battlefield. It sits at a high point. So from wherever the German army was sat, especially at the western end of Pozieres, they dominate the ground. And the German army had been dug in here since 1914. It's chalky ground. They've not only been dug underneath the ground, because the ground is really conducive to building underground tunnels. There were warrens of them. But also they'd used concrete bunkers and dug up on the ground. And dominating the Pozieres, the western end of Pozieres village, was a position known as Gibraltar. And this was a huge bunker. It was like a block of flats. And it had a 360-degree view of the battlefield. And this is what would be facing the 1st Australian Division. Now, if you look at the ground today, you have two valleys either side of the main Albert Boat Palm Road. One is called Sausage Valley, one is called Mash Valley, Sausage and Mash Valley. And the way the Australians, the 1st Australian Division, come into the line is using these valleys, this dead ground. So they can't be seen necessarily by the naked eye. And they're using whatever kind of dead ground, sunken lanes, to get up to position in order to be ready to attack on the time when they are set to attack the German positions. Some of the gunners are, I can't remember his name now, he's a sergeant, but he pulls his gun right up along a sunken road until it's almost in line with the Gibraltar. And in order to aid the attacking infantry, he fires round after round after round into the German positions to soften them up before the Australians will eventually attack. The Australians will attack. They attack during the night at the German positions. And because of the preparation that Walker has insisted upon, because of the time he has been allowed to register his guns and to keep pounding into the German positions, that first attack by the 1st Australian Division is what we call a successful attack. They take a huge amount of casualties, but we achieve our objectives. Very shortly, Gibraltar is surrounded and overwhelmed by Australian troops. Now, what happens once you attack and you get into those German positions? You consolidate your troops, so you begin to assess the situation, and then you prepare for another attack. And what that means is that the infantry have a bit of time to be drawn out of the line. Fresh troops will take over from them. But all the logistical effort behind you is working frantically to dig new communication trenches. We get into German positions, but of course all the German positions are facing the opposite way that we want to attack. So all those positions have to be turned around, and this involves the work of Australian engineers. The guns have to re-register again onto targets that were far further forward. So when we think, yeah, that was a successful attack, there is a whole system of work that's frantically going on apace behind in order to prepare for that second phase. But overall, the 1st Australian Division's first attack under the command of Walker was a success, very different to when they are relieved by the 2nd Australian Division and will be attacking towards the Windmill, which is moving further east up through Pozzia's village.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
A couple of things I recall about the first phase of this attack from reading veterans' accounts was, firstly, when we talk about the village of Pozières, I'll use that in quote marks because there was not a building left. It had been so smashed by artillery fire. I heard one veteran say the only way you knew when you were in what used to be the village was the mud was a shade of red because of the brick dust had been mixed up with the dirt. And so the ground was slightly red in hue because of the brick dust churned up there. That was the only way you knew you were in the village. But also Gibraltar, that big bunker that you mentioned, a fascinating story, one that I always enjoy telling people when I'm there, is that after they captured this pillbox and they captured a number of Germans in and around it and they removed them and sent them back for interrogation, and the first thing that they said was, do you know who the enemy was that captured you? They said to the Germans, and the Germans said, yes, we know it's the Australians. And when they asked how they knew that, they said because the night before the attacks, the Australians had advanced right up next to Gibraltar and then attacked overnight to capture it. Before they attacked it, the Australians had been calling out to the Germans throughout the night and yelling out to the defenders, we're coming to get you, Jerry. You know, the Australians are here. You better look out. And so so by the time they were overrun and captured, the Germans knew very well who they were facing. Yeah. So, you know, the cheeky Aussies, I could just imagine them digging in and yelling out to this big pillbox that are about to attack the next day that we're on our way, boys. Yeah. You know, look out, Germans, here we come. So I do always love those little Australian stories. But you're right, the 1st Division did a monumental job capturing the remains of the village and this high ground. And it had been an area where the attack had stalled for several days. And so it was great to see the Australians come in and take that ground. But, of course, the work was only just beginning because now the absolutely exhausted and shattered 1st Division, who'd suffered very high casualties, were relieved by the 2nd Division. who had to continue the attack. And so tell us about particularly this famous thing I'm sure many people have heard about, the windmill at Pozieres. What was the windmill and where was it located?
Well, effectively, there wasn't a windmill when the battle was there. There had been a windmill there in previous years, but it's really the windmill is the highest point you're on. From wherever you're stood on the windmill, even today, you can stand on this site. And there's still remnants of what would have been a concrete structure there, a building there, which is been left, really. You can see the remnants there. But it is there's nothing of a huge memorial there. It's just the ground. And it holds a resonance today, but it is the highest point. It sits at the eastern.
It's a rough mound, isn't it? It's the same as it was during the battle. It's just a sort of a rough earthen mound, which was effectively the foundations of the windmill. And today the mound is still there and covered with grass. And if you go to the diorama at the Australian War Memorial and see the diorama of Pozieres, on the horizon, you see the little mound, which is the windmill, as the Australians attack towards it. Very different place today from what you see in that diorama. In the diorama, it was just a devastated landscape with this little mound, the only high point. And, of course, today there's a pretty little village there, but it's a fabulously historic place, isn't it, when you stand there?
Yeah. And so this is the objective of the 2nd Australian Division under its commander, a guy called Legg. Now, this becomes a little bit controversial, even more controversial if you're a British guy trying to tell Australians, because Legg was not a particularly good general. He's ordered by Gough. Gough orders Birdwood to order Legg to go to attack. And for whatever reason, there's a possibility that everybody who's coming out onto the Western Front, you want to be the divisional commander that is extremely successful. So I think there's a certain element of that. But nevertheless, Legg sends his 2nd Division into attack, and it is a complete disaster. And what you've got to imagine when you're standing up on these quiet fields, that the battlefield had been so pummeled and so pounded, forget sort of trench systems, as it were. If you're trying to fight forward, as the Australian troops were, take the German positions, you lose all reference points. And like Matt was saying earlier, you're quite right. The only way you could fathom out what was the village is red brick dust. But anywhere where there's a reference point has completely disappeared. And this affects your fighting troops fighting forward. It affects your communications. Because as you're fighting forward, you might have troops that have got into the German positions, the front and second line positions. So what you're going to be doing is you're going to be sending a runner back with a message, giving a message telling them of the situation you're in. But your runner is trying to find his way back to maybe battalion headquarters, divisional headquarters, with absolutely no idea of where to go. It may take him, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours to get back, by which time the position on the battlefield has changed. So you enter a phase where everything is completely confused. One side doesn't really know what the other side is doing. That initial attack, though, by 2nd Australian Division is a disaster. Legg is ordered to pull his men back from the battlefield, and they undergo a phase where he pulled his men back. His men have to retrain or regroup, reorganize, and they undergo a period where there is an actual plan of attack, and this is postponed a number of times. Again, Gough grudgingly gives a postponement in order for the 2nd Australian Division to attack again on the windmill at Pozieres Ridge. And most famously, one of their battalions, 14th Battalion, you will see the involvement of Albert Jacka on the battlefield. Again, a bit of a controversial action because he is defending a dugout when all of a sudden, so allegedly the story goes, some Germans, having taken Australians prisoner, bypass the dugout and lob a grenade into it. And according to the story, Jacka is wounded in that attack, but nevertheless, with his ears ringing, he comes out with a load of Australian mates, and there ensues a hand-to-hand sort of combat fight, quite brutal, you know, bayonets, knuckle dusters, anything you can pick up to fight with, you're going to be fighting. But they take the Germans prisoner. The Australians that the Germans have held, realizing that suddenly they're free, throw themselves into the melee on the battlefield. And there's many that think that Albert Jacka, for that action, should have been awarded a bar to his Victoria Cross. But Albert Jacka is one of these, he's a true soldier. He's one of these men that has a bit of a disregard for saluting officers on the battlefield, very much respected by his men. But for whatever the reason, he is awarded a different medal as to the Victoria Cross, a different gallantry medal. He doesn't quite reach that Victoria Cross. And still today, it's a controversial piece of the battle that he should have possibly been awarded a bar to his VC. Eventually, the windmill will be taken by the 2nd Australian Division, a controversial battle. But then all eyes move to one of this strongly fortified position, a position known as Mukau Farm, Mukau Farm or Mucky Farm, depending on which side you're on. I think it's a Mucky Farm for the British and Mukau Farm for the Australians. As Geoffrey Malins calls it, this is one of the most strongly fortified positions on the whole of the Pozieres Ridge Line.
So that was very well described, Joe. Thank you for that. That epic second phase of the battle when they had to take not just the windmill, but the two very strong German trench lines, OG1 and OG2. And I remember, again, a veteran account talking about that they the second wave went forward after a first wave had gone in to attack the German trenches. The second wave went in and found the first wave lying down in front of the barbed wire. And so the second wave lay down alongside them, expecting, okay, they must be lying there getting ready to make a second charge. And it took them some minutes to realise that the men weren't lying there waiting for another charge. They're all dead. Yeah. And so just the sort of horrors that you get on the battlefield. And it's, again, it's an extraordinary area. We won't talk about the awful redevelopment that's currently going on there with the new memorials that are being privately built there. Let's skip that entirely. You can look that up on social media if you're interested in hearing about that. Such an epic place for Australians to visit. I mean, epic in the legitimate sense of it, not in the modern sense of it, but just as we said about Fromelles last week, there's just a weight in the air when you're on this site. You stand on the windmill and you look out and you just realise that not just a few hundred or a few thousand, but tens of thousands of Australians were killed or wounded in the fields immediately in front of you. And there's even a bench next to the windmill now in that sort of little memorial park, which says the Australians captured this windmill and fell more thickly on this ridge than on any other battlefield of the war. It's just again, such an important place for Australians. But you were quite right, Joe, that the attention now turned northwards to Mukau Farm, and there's almost a little bit of a swing around in the direction of advance here. Now that Pozieres had been taken, the high ground had been taken, the village of Pozieres was linked with another village, Thiepval, along what was known as Thiepval Ridge, and the British had suffered horrendous casualties trying to basically advance up the side of the ridge and take it head on. So now that the Australians had captured Pozieres, the instruction was advance along the ridge line to try and take the village of Thiepval effectively from behind. But in between Pozieres and Thiepval is this, as you say, Mukau Farm. I mean, it's a humorous name, but there is nothing funny at all about what happened at Mukau Farm. And when I was first learning about the battles on the Western Front, this name just personified everything gallant and horrific about the First World War, because the fighting at Mukau Farm was some of the bloodiest and confused fighting of the Battle of the Somme. And just talk us through. I mean, it's a very complicated battle. When you read about it in official histories, it's hard to follow because there's virtually no landmarks on the battlefield, so they resort to map references and the troops will advance from point 67 to point 402, and it gets very confusing. But just give us an overview of what it was like for those soldiers trying to just inch their way towards the heavily defended Mukau Farm.
Okay, so we say farewell, really, to the 2nd Australian Division, and they are relieved by the 4th Australian Division. And as you quite rightly say, the whole kind of advance moves northwards, or Thiepval is the prize, the village of Thiepval is the prize. The problem that the Australians have got is that the Mukau Farm, or Mukau Farm, whatever you want to call it, sits in a kind of valley. So anybody attacking from the position the Australians would be attacking, you're almost silhouetted on a skyline. The other problem you have with Mukau Farm is the Germans had made sure this was one of the most strongly defended fortified positions on the Somme battlefield. There is still a farm today, but if you remember, I said the ground here is chalky. It's really easy to dig through. The farm had a massive cellar, and what the Germans had done was they dug out from the farm underground warrens of tunnels. There's a kind of dip as you come down the hill on the coach, which has a copse of trees. This was known as the quarry. And they dug through to the quarry. So whatever the Australians would be attacking from the Pozieres ridgeline, you've got the German army popping up almost like rabbits from holes and just mowing men down. We roll from from the end of July through into August and then into September. And try as they might, the Australians are trying to get past Mouquet Farm. Now, Mouquet Farm has a series of trenches. You have Skyline Trench, Park Lane Trench, and then Zigzag Trench that goes up the sidelines. These are all interconnected with machine gun positions and fortified bunkers. So it is like a complete strong post. And when we talk about the Australians attacking, what we generally don't talk about is that when the Australians weren't attacking, the German army were counterattacking. So you have this ebb and flow going on throughout the whole of the end of July, throughout the whole of August, through into September. The end of August, when the 4th Australian Division are attacking and trying to get through into the farm, to add to the sheer misery on the battlefield, it starts to rain. And there's accounts of the attack going in here, very similar to what the Australians would experience up at Third Ypres. The misery of attacking in mud-filled shell holes and trenches that are constantly being filled with water, decomposing corpses. And the mud is your enemy as well as the German army is. Your rifle gets clogged with mud, so it doesn't work. If your rifle doesn't work, you lose the ability to fire on the enemy. You know, even if you stop for a brief bite of a hardtack biscuit, that is filled with mud. If you stop to, the battle stops for you to get a bit of a freshen up to clean your teeth, your toothbrush is filled with mud. So the mud and the wet gets in, is your enemy as much as the German army are. And the German army are reluctant and will not give up this position at all costs. They know that if Mouquet Farm falls, then the way is open for the Australians to attack Thiepval. So they will hold on to this tenacious grip with a will that is like steel. The Australians also have this will of steel to try and get through to the farm, but try as they might, they can't. The very last attack at Mouquet Farm is undertaken, I think, by the 49th, 51st and 52nd Battalions. And one of the last messages that comes from an officer attacking along Zigzag Trench, I think, is point 52, holding out, but please get our guns forward. We cannot hold on for much longer. And I believe that group of Australian soldiers, that was the last message. And their bodies, I believe, were recovered when they were widening the road back in the 80s or 90s. Mouquet Farm wouldn't fall. The Germans tenaciously held on to their grip. And consequently, Thiepval doesn't fall from behind. Thiepval is eventually taken from a frontal assault, but only in October 1916, when we're getting towards the end, really, of the Battle of the Somme. But that, from Pozieres Ridge down to Mouquet Farm, that is your 1.5 square miles of what is really Australian DNA, I suppose you could call it, because I would invite anybody who is Australian to come out to that particular battlefield today and say there is not some point of Australian DNA still in the ground here. There is so many still missing that the whole of the area, I would argue, is a memorial to the Australians in itself.
It's just an extraordinary place, Joe, as you say. Thousands of Australians missing there, not just a couple of dozen or a couple of hundred. Literally thousands of Australians are still there beneath that ground. And we visit the village of Pozières, and there's the wonderful 1st Division Memorial to the 1st Division. Yep. The windmill site is now a memorial to all the Australians, but it was originally a memorial to the 2nd Division that fought there. There's no memorial to the 4th Division. Their memorial's way in the east at Bellenglise to reflect the good work they did throughout the entire Western Front campaign. But that drive, when we leave Pozières, you get back in your car or back on the coach, and your next stop is always going to be Thiepval, the wonderful memorial to the British missing at Thiepval. And so that's one of the most important sites on the Western Front. And so you drive from Pozières to Thiepval. It takes 5 or 6 minutes. You cover these farm fields. You go past a little farm on the right, and, you know, people are back on the coach and they're relaxing and having a sip of water and chatting about what they've just seen. But we're covering this ground that is the scene of so much bloodshed, and in some ways a little bit different to Pozières, where Pozières is quite a glorious battlefield. This was, even though it was costly, it was a scene of a great Australian victory. The slog towards Mouquet Farm, as you say, through the mud, it was literally inch by inch. It was men just going from shell hole to shell hole and losing half their number, and the survivors then getting reinforced and then pushing on to the next shell hole or the next trench or the next, you know, crossroads or the quarry. It was just horrific. And I remember years ago reading a letter that had been written after the war in the early 1920s by a mother from Sydney writing to the War Department to say there still has not been any word of my two sons who were fighting at Pozières in 1916. And then sadly the reply is also in the file, that she got the reply from the War Department to say there's been nothing heard of them. So I think you can just assume that they both fell in that action, that glorious action at Mouquet Farm. And for so many Australian families, that name, Mouquet Farm, a very unusual French name, but it just came to personify the horror of the First World War, and so many Australians were lost there. So it's just an extraordinary place. Joe, how do you find it when you go back there and when you take Australians back to walk the ground? I mean, I know that when I've led tours there, a number of times I've been there with family members who either someone was killed or wounded. So many men were killed or wounded at Pozières that it really was a big dividing line in the war. You see men that either fought up until Pozières or from Pozières onwards. Not a lot of men actually fought through that time. So how do you find it heading back there and leading relatives back there in particular?
Well, it's a big honour for me to take Australian relatives back, I think more so, and I'm not saying that just because I'm on an Australian podcast here, but I mentioned it earlier, that the Australians come such a long way. And what we've got to remember is at the end of the war, it was relatively easy for British widows or pilgrims to come out onto the battlefield. We can be there relatively easily because it's not too far away. But for some of these women back in Australia, there was nothing. There was nothing to cut. They didn't have the means. They didn't have the wherewithal to get halfway round the world, and that must have been soul destroying. I mean, if you can imagine getting that letter and that finality of that black letter telling them that their sons were missing, and the thought that you are never going to see them again, and the possibility that you are never going to see where they lost their lives. So for me, I find it really humbling to bring Australian passengers. And sometimes you'll be on a coach and you'll be speaking to a passenger. We always get the pilgrimages. We always parachute them into our tour. And wherever possible, we make sure that we get to where these people are remembered. But quite often, it will be somebody coming back for the first time. You know, the family have not come back and this is the first time. And so for me, it is as emotional a thing to do, and it's the one thing that I go back at the end of the day having done my job and said, right, this is why I do what I do, because to give the people that maybe a sense of closure, to be able to be to share in that those pilgrimages is one of the best things about doing my job. And some of these, like we say, it might be the first time they come back. So that, for me, is quite a humbling experience.
We've used the right word there, Joe, a pilgrimage. When family members visit a grave for the first time on these tours, even if they're removed by several generations, it's still a very special moment to stand there with them. So it's been very special to walk this ground with you, Joe, in this virtual sense, to talk about the Battle of Pozieres and Fromelles last week. And don't forget, if you've been listening to this or watching this video and want to join us, you can walk the ground and see these sites as well on one of our tours. It's the thing we love doing more than anything else. So please, we would love you to join us on the battlefields and bring this history to life. But Joe, we'll get you back on very soon on the podcast. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And until I see you on the battlefields very soon, or until we have you back on the show, just thanks so much for joining us.
And thank you very much for inviting me. It's been a real pleasure, and I really look forward to seeing you all back on the Western Front as soon as possible.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review for the podcast, and visit livinghistorytv.com for more great history content.